Hello there. Today is Thursday, February 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington.
And I'm Steve Miller. Are the precautionary steps being taken by schools, businesses, and governments going too far?
I think the reaction is right and it's appropriate. And the reason is the early data indicated a pretty high death rate.
Plus, what to make out of the turnaround and dropouts in the U.S. primaries.
If you think about the forces of partisan polarization that are happening between Democrats and Republicans, we're now seeing all of that same kind of phenomenon happening within the Democratic Party.
We'll have those stories and more next.
All right. Well, Democrats and Republicans came together in the House of Representatives Wednesday to pass an $8.3 billion emergency spending bill to help reduce the spread of the coronavirus in the U.S. The bipartisan effort came as more cases were reported. And in California, Governor Gavin Newsom declared a statewide emergency after that state saw its first death from the new coronavirus. Officials say an elderly patient who apparently contracted the COVID-19 virus on a cruise died in Northern California.
During a news briefing with a new coronavirus task force, Vice President Mike Pence said the virus continues to spread.
To be clear, if you are a healthy American, the risk of contracting the coronavirus remains low.
He also sought to reassure American citizens. Joining us now to discuss the impacts further is Ator Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center and the founding director of the Division of Medical Ethics.
All right. Well, is the world overreacting to this outbreak, Professor Kaplan, or is this at the appropriate level of concern?
I think the reaction is right and it's appropriate. And the reason is the early data out of China, where this thing started, indicated a pretty high death rate, much more dangerous than the flu, for example, which kills a lot of people, probably in the U.S., 40,000 to 60,000 a year, that many, and that it was highly communicable, easy to catch it. So even though we're not seeing death rates anywhere near that, you can see that in some countries, Iran, South Korea, things are percolating along pretty fast, and that's even with, you know, some pretty tough responses to try and isolate and quarantine. But the death rate is scary, and the ease with which people seem to acquire the disease is scary. Maybe it'll turn out that it's an overestimate or overblown, but right now I think we're doing the right thing.
The World Health Organization says that it's about 3.4% of people infected with the virus globally have died. Mm-hmm. That would be a lot more lethal than the common flu. Would you say that in itself is a big concern?
That number in itself, the death rate from new coronavirus versus the flu, is really concerning because it's like 10 times bigger. It's way bigger, and the flu does a lot of harm. Plus, we know that the flu is something that many people get and seem to survive. It seems that fewer people, particularly among the elderly, are surviving this new coronavirus. So, yeah, it's very, very concerning that that death rate is so high, even though a lot of people are going to get this virus and some may not even notice.
Would you say that the reason the death rate can be so high with people in vulnerable populations like the elderly is because we have not developed an immune system to it? Or is it just a more deadly virus, or do we just not know yet?
Well, it's clear that what happened was a cold virus mutated. And viruses do that. They recombine, and they've learned through evolution that changing your DNA in subtle ways gives you a better chance to exist and to attack hosts who over time build up some resistance to you. So if you change your DNA and you're a cold virus, then if humanity starts to build up some immunity to the cold virus, if you change a little bit, you got new hosts, you can go on. So I think we don't have immunity to this. We may start to see people build it up. And at the same time, the change that occurred makes it nastier and makes it easier to catch. So both.
What about the fact that we see some of these countries like South Korea testing people by the thousands, even having drive-by tests? Mm-hmm. And here it seems to be difficult to even get tested. So we don't really know how many people could be walking around carrying this or and not showing any symptoms. How much of a concern is that?
Well, I think the United States got off on the wrong foot when it comes to surveillance, which you do by randomly testing the population, just seeing who seems to have the virus so you get some idea of what's going on out there. We were testing by who had been in a country where they might have contracted it. We were, in a sense, testing the most at-risk groups. But that doesn't tell you how fast is the virus spreading here. And I think that what will happen is we'll see a jump in the next week or two in the number of cases. Not because more people are getting it, but because we're starting to measure it.
Do you think that we're getting the accurate numbers here and in China?
I don't. I don't think we've still got enough testing going on. So, no, I'm not convinced that the numbers are accurate in terms of who's got the disease. And I think in China, there has been a problem. They may have more deaths because they're not really set up in the way, say, the U.S. healthcare system is, with intensive care units, a lot of ventilators to help people breathe. What kills you is pneumonia. We're pretty good at treating that. I'm not sure all of the hospital system in China is as good. So that death rate that came out of China may be higher there than it may turn out to be, say, in South Korea or in the U.S. It may, however, be relevant to Iran. They may not have the same level of high-tech healthcare. U.S. has a different problem. We've got some people who don't have health insurance, so they may stay away from the healthcare system and not even get measured in surveillance. And that's a problem because if you're hiding because you're worried that someone may kick you out of the country because you don't have documentation, or if you're just poor and you think, well, I'm going to not show up anywhere to let anybody test me because I don't have any money, those hinder accurate counts. I think we're going to see a lot more cases in the U.S. in the next few weeks. It's going to look worse. Is it worse than it is right now? I'm not sure, but I think we're going to discover a lot more people have this virus than we think. And what I'm a little bit concerned about is it is true that many cold viruses and flu viruses, they kind of wane when the weather warms up because people are outdoors more, they have more social distance, they're not in close quarters at work, and so that cuts back on communicability of the disease. I'll bet that this thing comes back next year. It's one thing to say, oh, we got a handle on it, but we shouldn't forget that cold viruses and the flu, they show up all the time, and there's no reason to think this one's going away.
You say we're going to see more cases. You think we're going to see more deaths then?
I think we'll see more cases. I think we'll see more deaths in the U.S. and in other countries. I think we'll see a peak. It'll start to diminish a little bit around, say, June. But come winter in the northern hemisphere, when people begin to move back indoors and have much more close contact with others, I think we're going to see it return in the October-November period, sadly.
All right, that's Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center and founding director of the Division of Medical Ethics.
As new cases of the coronavirus continue to spread in at least 80 countries worldwide, airlines are grounding planes, travel restrictions widen, and the economic impacts continue to grow. The United Nations analysis of the global trade impact of the coronavirus epidemic finds nations have been hit with export losses of about $50 billion in February, and the world should brace itself for worse things to come the longer the epidemic continues. International Monetary Fund Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva announced a $50 billion aid package Wednesday to help fight the coronavirus.
We have a baseline scenario that is relatively mild impact, and then we have more dire scenarios we are considering. Unfortunately, we have moved in the territory of these more dire scenarios.
She said the IMF now expects 2020 world growth to be below the 2.9% rate for 2019, and revised forecasts will be issued in the coming weeks.
Well, the field of Democratic presidential candidates got a bit smaller on Super Tuesday with what appears to be now a two-man race between former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders. One of them will likely take on President Donald Trump in November's general election. Biden landed victories in 10 of the 14 states for a striking comeback.
Former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, who did not perform as well as he had hoped given the millions of dollars he spent on his short-lived campaign, he told supporters he is dropping out of the presidential race but not stepping back from the issues.
I've always believed that defeating Donald Trump starts with uniting behind the candidate with the best shot to do it. And after yesterday's vote, it is clear that candidate is my friend and a great American, Joe Biden.
Meanwhile, Senator Bernie Sanders also spoke after a surprisingly underperforming night. In a news conference, Sanders said he likes Biden, but they have very different ideas.
I like Joe. Joe is a decent guy, and I do not want this campaign to degenerate into a Trump-type effort where we're attacking each other, where it's personal attacks. That is the last thing this country wants. Joe has his ideas, his record, his vision for the future. I have mine.
But given the extraordinary win from the former vice president Tuesday night, the field has narrowed in a way that Democrats hope will bring them together. Joining us now is Jennifer Victor, associate professor of political science at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. How unprecedented do you see the turn of events in the Democratic race, given the vice president's unexpectedly good performance?
From my perspective, I think of this as a party coordination problem, right? I know political parties can get somewhat maligned these days because they are associated with the idea of hyper-partisanship. But in reality, political parties are really important institutions for democracies. And this, what we're seeing here is an example of one of the main political parties in the United States, the Democrats, trying to go through this process of selecting their nominee for the general election. And decades ago, or actually not even all that long ago, not more than a decade ago, really, this coordination process would often happen largely behind closed doors. And the public wouldn't really get all that close to it until voting started happening. And once voting started happening, it was often the case that there was a nominee that was already sort of ahead of the game and had received a lot of nominations and so forth. And essentially what's happening now is that process still happens, but it happens much more in the public eye, and it's happening kind of on a later calendar schedule. So instead of all of that party coordinating and everybody looking at everybody else, seeing who's going to jump first and which horse they're all going to put their money on, that process is happening in a open, transparent kind of way after the Iowa caucuses already started, rather than before and behind closed doors. So it's a similar process, but it's going about in a different kind of way.
We seem to have two front runners that are very different. Bernie Sanders, who has called himself a Democratic socialist, Joe Biden, a lifelong Democrat, very much in the center. It wasn't expected to turn out this way. It was sort of a letdown for Bernie and sort of a surprise for Mr. Biden, who seems to have people coming now and endorsing him. And does it say something about the climate, though, from the American public perspective of what they're looking for, or does it still say that they're very divided?
To some extent, I mean, one way to think about it is if you think about the forces of partisan polarization that are happening between Democrats and Republicans and how they're moving further apart and we're seeing more extremism and there's more of this negative association with the other party that drives people's political preferences, we're now seeing all of that same kind of phenomenon happening within the Democratic Party. So we both have inter-party polarization and intra-party polarization. And I don't think we know for sure yet what's driving some of that intra-party polarization in the Democratic Party, but it's certainly the case that the Democratic Party has this really broad coalition of interests. And if you think about the last number of candidates that the Democratic Party has nominated the last several cycles, mm-hmm. they did tend to be more pragmatic, maybe ideologically moderate figures who were trying to pull together as many of those fragmented pieces of that broad Democratic coalition as they possibly could.
And Jennifer Victor, associate professor of political science at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University.
Israel appeared headed into another political stalemate on Wednesday after nearly complete results indicated that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu failed to secure a clear majority for a right-wing bloc in parliament despite his claim of victory. Reuters' Soroya Ali has more.
Israel's political instability may not be going away. final results from their latest election were released Wednesday, and it suggests Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has failed to secure a clear majority, despite his earlier claim of victory. Monday's election was the country's third vote in just less than a year, and exit polls originally indicated Netanyahu's right-wing Likud party were ahead of the pack. But now, with no clear majority, the country could return to deadlock. That could mean weeks more horse trading to secure a coalition with no guarantee of success. Netanyahu tried and failed this twice last year. Or an alliance. Netanyahu's best bet would be if right-wing but fiercely secular Avigdor Lieberman agrees to sit with his ultra-Orthodox religious allies. His main challenger, centrist Benny Gantz from the Blue and White Party, has refused to join a coalition, citing Netanyahu's ongoing legal troubles.
Be much more united.
Israel's longest-serving leader is battling charges of bribery, breach of trust, and fraud. Although he denies any wrongdoing, Bibi will be working against the clock to find a solution before he goes to trial on March 17th. All sides are under huge public pressure to put their differences aside, form a government, and most importantly, avoid yet another national election.
That was Reuters reporter Soraya Ali.
The International Atomic Energy Agency is reporting that Iran has nearly tripled its stockpile of enriched uranium since November. That is in violation of its deal with world powers. The report also raises new questions about possible nuclear-related activities and undeclared nuclear material at three locations. The IAEA said it has sent questions to Iran in three separate letters, but Tehran maintains it is not obligated to respond. Joining us for analysis is Benham Bentaleblou of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Thank you for being with us. So what does this all mean?
Well, while everything else is going on with Iran and the headlines and the possible conflict that has been averted between the U.S. and Iran because of terrorism in Iraq, as well as the killing of Major General Qasem Soleimani, Iran, per its policy last May, continues to expand its nuclear program every 60 days. And in an election year, it looks like the Islamic Republic is gambling that the more low-enriched uranium it stockpiles, the more that could generate international risks and concerns over the direction of its program and thus actually be an impediment to future sanctions and perhaps even force premature sanctions relief, or perhaps even force Washington back into the deal that is called fatally flawed.
How are they able to do this with all these sanctions on them? I would think that they would be hurting pretty badly economically, and it can't be cheap to develop these materials.
Well, that's right. And by most, if not all, macroeconomic measures, the sanctions, is popularly called the maximum pressure sanctions, which in many ways resurrected penalties that were once waived by the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear deal, those are having a battering effect on the Iranian economy and in record time. But one of the flaws of that nuclear deal was it didn't require the destruction of a lot of the material, particularly the centrifuges and other machines used to enrich uranium. In fact, it required that Iran simply store them or disconnect them or put them in warehouses. So as Iran brings more machines online, it is now willing to simply not ship out the uranium that those machines enrich that is over 300 kilograms. And Iran has breached that 300 kilogram limit this summer and has accumulated so much LEU, so much low-enriched uranium, that according to the New York Times today, it looks like they have more than enough LEU for one nuclear bomb's worth based on report requirements for one bomb.
Now, when the JCPOA nuclear deal was implemented, it appeared by all indications from the International Atomic Energy Agency that Iran was complying and they were not developing. Now, there were concerns that they would at some point start up again, but at least it seemed to have slowed this down. And now that the U.S. pulled out of the deal, it seems like they've ramped that up. Would it seem that it might have been a better idea to stay in this deal, at least with Iran complying and having oversight?
Well, the way Washington left the deal certainly brings forward a crisis that was going to happen anyway. Sometimes, listening to the analysis on both sides of the aisle here in Washington, it seems that deal supporters don't make the best argument for the deal, and really the best argument for the deal that it was a time-buying mechanism, and that if you did frame the JCPOA as a time-buying mechanism to push off the nuclear issue for at least a decade, as well as a couple of other things before a decade, then perhaps we could have said, is it worthwhile to relieve sanctions for X period of time, or is it not worthwhile to relieve sanctions for this period of time? That debate, unfortunately, didn't happen. Nonetheless, Iran, because of the way the deal was structured, is able to bring these machines back online faster. And it itself is choosing to repel the crisis in this fashion. There's lots of other options they could do. They could simply continue to conform. We know the policy under the first year of max pressure was to try to wait out the Trump administration without going into gross violations of the nuclear deal.
What sort of ability does the world have to control what Iran does as far as nuclear proliferation?
Well, a little bit of positive news is that the new Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Director General Grossi, seems to be taking a firmer line with the Islamic Republic, talking about the need for enhanced transparency. We know this was a deal, the 2015 nuclear deal, sold on enhanced transparency, but there is less robust quantitative and qualitative data after the deal that we have publicly through open sources on the nuclear program than we did prior to the deal. And it seems like the IAEA is not just concerned about the nuclear program, the nuclear deal, the JCPOA anymore. It really is talking about these bigger structural things that Iran may or may not be in violation of, such as the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the Additional Protocol, the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement. And that's not to say that the IAEA was purely politicized under the deceased Director General Amano's leadership, but that I think there was a political zeitgeist at play as to how the international community was looking at Iran's nuclear program.
It's Ben Talablu of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Coming up,
the BAL, the Basketball Africa League, this would be its first season of play.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists from the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand say they have discovered remnants of the biggest explosion in the universe since the Big Bang nearly 14 billion years ago. Using data from space and ground-based observatories, the researchers say the massive explosion was found in the Ophiuchus Galaxy Supercluster, located about 390 million light-years from Earth. One of the scientists says the explosion happened very slowly and took place over hundreds of millions of years. The researchers say there is a supermassive black hole in one of the supercluster's galaxies and that they think it was what set off the record-setting explosion. The lead author of a study detailing the discovery says that you could fit 15 Milky Way galaxies in a row inside the crater the explosion created in the galaxy cluster's field of hot gas. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller, along with my colleague Lori London. The Basketball Africa League was supposed to tip off Friday for its inaugural season, Friday, March 13th in Dakar, Senegal, but that is not going to be. Rather than chalking it up to triskaidekaphobia, I sat down with the Sunny Side of Sports host, Sonny Young, to get those details.
Well, Steve, the BAL issued a statement from its president, Amadou Gallo Fall, who is from Senegal, which is where they wanted to hold the opening weekend of action. And he said the Senegalese government recommended they postpone the start of league play because of what he described as the escalating health concerns related to the coronavirus. The BAL, the Basketball Africa League, this would be its first season of play, sort of jointly sponsored by the International Basketball Federation, FIBA, but the league that's pretty much bankrolling it is the National Basketball Association, or NBA.
And this is really the first time that the NBA is trying to start a new league or supporting a league outside of the Americas.
That's true, and I think the NBA looks at the BAL as not so much a minor league, but a developmental league that can produce players for the NBA down the road. Now, not every player that enters the BAL will make it to the NBA, but it's still a great chance for them to display their skills for a wider audience. And, it's a win-win, I think, for both leagues.
This is not a league just for one area of Africa. This is encompassing the entire continent.
Good point. Many of the best players from Africa that are currently in the NBA have come from West Africa, but this is not a regional-type league. It does span the entire continent of Africa. Worth mentioning the countries where these teams are based. They are, in alphabetical order, Algeria, Angola, Cameroon, Egypt, Madagascar, Mali, Morocco, Mozambique, Nigeria, Rwanda, Senegal, and Tunisia. So we have North African countries, East African countries, West Africa. It is an African league. And so it does showcase players from across Africa.
Any idea of how long this postponement is going to be? I know the announcement just came out, but any idea that they were able to share?
Well, they did not name a specific date when they would like to begin play. However, if we look at it in relation to all the other sporting events that have been either postponed or canceled, I'm thinking it could be a few months before they begin play. I look at it that the NBA will begin its playoffs in April, and I don't know that the BAL would want to compete
with that,
with the NBA playoffs, which is really a marquee event for the NBA.
Speaking of postponement, the question on a lot of people's mind is July, the Tokyo Olympics this year. And there's been an ongoing discussion with the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, and the WHO and Tokyo officials as to whether or not the games should take place. Do you have any updates on what people are saying about that?
Well, the IOC president, Thomas Bach, this week was adamant that the games will go forward as scheduled, opening ceremony scheduled for July 24th. However, with all these other sporting events that have been postponed or canceled in Asia, pressure could build on the IOC, which would have the final say on whether the game should be postponed or canceled. In terms of the calendar, I'm thinking the IOC might wait until maybe May before making a final decision on a postponement or cancellation.
That was VOA's Sonny Young. Now you can catch the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Well, European Union leaders unveiled their new environment plan while Swedish activist Greta Thunberg was in town. But if they were hoping to impress her, they failed. Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder has details.
If EU leaders wanted to impress Greta Thunberg by unveiling their new climate law in front of her, it didn't work. She savaged it in a speech to the European Parliament in Brussels on Wednesday.
This climate law is surrender. Because nature doesn't bargain, and you cannot make deals with physics.
The 17-year-old Swedish activist, seen here in Bristol, England last Friday, accused EU governments and institutions of only pretending to tackle the climate crisis. EU leaders say they're spearheading some of the most ambitious climate policies in the world. This latest law reduces net greenhouse gas emissions to zero by 2050. It would give the EU executive powers to set tougher goals for governments every 5 years. But those powers only kick in after 2030. Too late, according to environment groups.
When your house is on fire, you don't wait a few more years to start putting it out. And yet, this is what the Commission are proposing today. When the EU presents this climate law and net zero by 2050, you indirectly admit surrender, that you are giving up on the Paris Agreement, giving up on your promises, and giving up on doing everything you possibly can to ensure a safe future for your own children.
The EU accounts for less than 10% of world greenhouse gas emissions, but Thunberg said developed countries who'd been polluting longest had a moral obligation to lead the way and cut carbon first and fastest. She'll lead a school strike for the climate in Brussels on Friday.
And that was Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder. That's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, thank you very much for listening.
And be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have an absolutely fantastic day.